case for argument is 21-1750, Landclose versus United States. Mr. Dahl, please proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court, and thank you, Your Honor, for allowing me to appear remotely today. As you are aware, as the court is aware, this case arises as a result of the insolvency of an annuity company, the Executive Life Insurance Company of New York, and this court has decided a number of cases and interpreted a number of different tort settlement agreements that have required interpretation because of the insolvency and the subsequent shortfall in annuity payments to various plaintiffs of those tort claims and that ended in the settlement agreement. We believe that there's really two rules, basic rules of contract interpretation, if they are applied. In this particular case, by this panel, that it will be found that the government is liable for the shortfall to Ms. Landclose. The first is that the plain and ordinary terms of an agreement should be applied unless it is clear that there was an agreement between the parties to use something other than the plain and ordinary meaning of the term. The other is that there should be harmony among all the terms in a settlement agreement, and the court is required when it interprets a settlement to harmonize the terms. And as the court is aware, Ms. Landclose was granted partial summary judgment by the Court of Federal Claims in 2017, and the government was found liable for the shortfall. But because of the Shaw case, which was before this court but had not been decided, the Court of Federal Claims granted an extension and reconsideration for the government.
Mr. Dahl, can you just point us to which provisions in the Landclose agreement that, in your view, are decisive in putting the government on the hook for the shortfalls in the annuity payments?
Yes, thank you. The first is, and this follows the Massey decision in 1999, but the first is that the monthly annuity payments are the payments at issue, but it's the purchase of an annuity which will provide. And this court in the Massey decision found that will provide, or an equivalent of will provide, shall be made, that was mandatory language, and that mandatory language, and since the United States and the annuity company wasn't a part of the settlement, but just the United States and the tort settlors, that was language that required the government to step in when the shortfall occurred. The second, important aspect.
Mr. Dahl, before you go to the other provision you want to rely on, in cases like Nutt and Shaw, aren't there similar provisions than to the one you just quoted? Like, for example, Shaw says the purchase of annuities, which will provide certain future periodic payments as set forth below. And then in Nutt, it says the United States of America agrees to purchase annuities, which will pay the following amounts. So I guess what I'm wondering is, aren't those provisions similar to the one you just pointed us to in the Landclose agreement, which says the purchase of an annuity, which will provide?
They are. There's no doubt that they are. But when taken as a whole, when compared to the Shaw and the Nutt agreement, when the settlement agreement is taken as a whole, then I will focus on the differences between this settlement and those two settlements and what makes that language important in this particular settlement. But you're correct that that's not the only, if that were the only term, that But I would still urge, when it's taken as a whole, that's an important aspect. The other is the guarantee language. And again, in this particular case, the term is, after the specific monthly installments are stated, all monthly payments above. And again, when it refers to the annuity monthly payments, it's clear that the annuity has not yet been purchased, and that the annuity will provide certain monthly payments. But then it goes to the present tense, and also it says all monthly payments above are guaranteed for 30 years of the life of Jennifer, whichever is longer. And that language is what the Court of Federal Claims found in 2017, that change of tenses, and along with just the ordinary and plain term guarantee, meant that in fact, that was the ordinary sense of guarantee, in the sense that the government was guaranteeing to pay if there was a shortfall or a default by the annuity company, rather than the term of art.
Counselor, this is Judge Rayner. So there's an argument being made that guaranteed is a term of art that applies to time schedules and timing, but that it cannot apply to monetary values as expressed through. Can you respond to that?
Yes, well, we don't think the term of art should have been applied in this particular case by the court because of, to harmonize the agreement, no protections were provided to the Langfloss family. In fact, if there was a default in that agreement, and when you harmonize that, it makes sense to use guarantee in the ordinary and common sense of what guarantee means. They were comfortable, the Langfloss family and their attorney were comfortable with the fact that the government was going to step in and, in fact, pay those installments if they didn't get paid by the annuity company. So that's the reason we don't think, and in fact, in the Nutt settlement, the Nutt distinguished Massey on the importance of the guarantee language in Massey. So it is true in the original decision in Massey, the court relied on the mandatory shall be paid language, but then Nutt looked back and distinguished and said, well, we don't find liability in the Nutt settlement, government liability, but an important, and we did find it in Massey, but we found it in Massey because of this guarantee language. So the court essentially revisited that and felt that in some circumstances, and evidently in Nutt, felt that guarantee should be used in its ordinary and common sense term, what we commonly think of when we hear the term guarantee. And so
can you, Shaw, Mr. Dahl, can you comment on Shaw? And Shaw construed are guaranteed in a way different than how you want us to construe are guaranteed in this case. Can you explain why we can do that?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. This court was compelled to do that, and this court was compelled to find it as a term of art because the consideration was specifically cabined into lump sum payments and the purchase of an annuity by the government. And I can read the specific language, and this court, in its decision, emphasizes this language. But before the specific lump sums are identified and before the annuity payments are identified, this court noted that the Shaw Agreement stated that payment by the United States of America of the cash sum set forth below, the initial lump sums, and the purchase of annuities, which will provide certain future periodic payments set forth below in paragraph 6, shall constitute a complete release of the Shaw's claims. So to harmonize that cabining of the, all the government needs to do is purchase the annuities and pay the cash sums, and in turn, you're going to give us a complete release. The court was compelled to find because a guarantee in its ordinary sense was inconsistent with that term. And so the court was compelled to find guarantee as a term of art. But you don't see that same cabining of the consideration to the annuity payments and the lump sums.
Mr. Dahl, this is Judge Moore. So as I look at Massey, Massey has guarantee language and mandatory shall be paid language. That seems to parallel your case, which has guarantee and will be paid language. Both seem sufficiently mandatory. In Massey, there was no express discussion of any release, and I wasn't able to find, because apparently it's only in storage and paper copy, the underlying settlement agreement from Massey. But there's no discussion in the opinion whatsoever of a release. Then we move forward to Shaw, and we have mandatory language and the word guaranteed again. But importantly, the point you just made, I'll read from page 45 of the appendix in Shaw, which is the actual release, which I think is the language you just read. The payment by the United States of America of the cash sum set forth in paragraph 5 and the purchase of annuities, which will be to provide certain future periodic payments that set forth in paragraph 6, shall constitute the complete release and bar to any and all causes of action. It then goes on to explain that if a third party has to be sued and the U.S. has to be involved, they'll be indemnified for any expenses they have. So isn't it fair to look at the Shaw settlement agreement as a whole as clearly seeking to take the government off the hook, not just for the number of years that the annuity will be paid, but also for whether the amount will continue to be paid? And if you contrast that with the settlement agreement in your case, if the release is only in consideration hereof, which necessarily means everything has to happen that is promised here. So isn't that sort of the critical difference that makes your case more like Massey and less like Shaw? Because all of them have mandatory seeming language. All of them use the word guarantee. But the release seems to be a critical difference.
I believe it is, Your Honor. Yes, I believe it is. And I believe this case is unique. This settlement agreement is unique. And when I say this settlement, I mean the Land Club settlement. It has absolutely no discussion of who the annuity company will be that will even, be processing the monthly annuity. In contrast, even in Shaw, it was identified at least that almost $3 million will be paid to Merrill Lynch Settlement Services, and they will place the annuity. But there were some protections and some, and of course in Nutt it went further and said, they gave the Nutt's permission to pursue the annuity company. So in any event, this settlement is very unique in that it's less than 2 pages long, but it's also, there's no discussion at all or no protections at all about the purchase of the annuity, who the government would use to purchase and fund the annuity, and I think that's very important as well.
But if there is some ambiguity in your settlement agreement, if we were to conclude there's ambiguity, for example, in what the word guaranteed really meant, who drafted this?
Well, it's our belief, I stated in my brief that, it has the government's file number on the first page of the settlement agreement, and that was evidence that they did it, and also it has internal machinations of how the, settlement will be processed and so on the second page, which indicates that the government, did draft it, so we have asserted that the government drafted it.
Have they disputed whether they drafted it?
They have not. I think in their response brief, they just said that the reasons we gave for saying that they drafted it were insufficient reasons to prove that they drafted it. I think that's the response.
If that were true, couldn't you introduce a declaration by one of the land closes that indicates at the time they didn't draft it, that it was drafted by the government?
I could, yes.
Why don't you save the rest of your time for rebuttal? You're almost out of time.
I will. Thank you.
Let's hear from the government. Mr. Schroeder, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The government had two obligations under the settlement agreement: to make a lump sum payment and to purchase an annuity. And upon purchasing the annuity, the government fulfilled its obligations by the settlement agreement's plain language. The agreement did not in any sense make the government liable for a default by the annuity company. It did not make it responsible for shortfalls. There's no language in the agreement that does that.
How do you distinguish this case from Massey?
Well, and Shaw actually... I don't want to know
how Shaw does. I want to know how you distinguish
yes.
the facts of this release from the Massey release, because the Shaw release looks very different for me from this release. So
okay.
tell me how this release differs from Massey.
Regarding the release language, in this case, there's a very broad release, and it states that, and this is, I'm talking about Lanclose now, it states that the agreement is in full satisfaction, final settlement of any and all claims which we have or may have against the United States and others affiliated with the United States for personal injuries sustained as a result of the alleged negligence on the part of the Air Force medical personnel at the U.S. Air Force Medical Center and the location on February 15th, 1982, and for any and all damages, losses, or injuries proximate and consequent thereto.
But the release itself is only in consideration hereof, which
yes.
means everything in the document. In consideration of everything in this document, we release the U.S.
In consideration, we read that as in consideration of the government's fulfilling its obligations, which, again, were to pay regarding Jennifer Lanclose, the plaintiff, to pay a $200,000 lump sum, paragraph 1, appendix 8, page 18, and to purchase an annuity, the purchase of annuity, setting forth the... that would provide the payments.
And
so
then the payments are guaranteed.
The payments are guaranteed pursuant to essentially the same language in Shaw, which is that in this case says provision that all monthly payments are guaranteed for 30 years or the life of Jennifer, whichever is longer. That has been construed in Shaw to mean that type of provision means that the longer of her life or 30 years. So if she lived 60 more
Shaw
years.
Shaw also said that that's what are guaranteed means generally in
yes.
the context of annuities. And
that's
then
right.
it said in the context of that agreement, it found that guaranteed just is referring to the term of the payments and not to the amount of the payments.
Yeah, and
then as I think Chief Judge Moore pointed out earlier, as did opposing counsel, there was a very specific release in the Shaw agreement that was tethered to the payment of the annuity, to the purchase of the annuity by the government. And through the purchase of the annuity, the government had exhausted its obligations under the agreement. And so now the court had to figure out, what do we do with the R guaranteed language? And I'm not saying this is right, but I'm saying there is a reading of that opinion that says to read all of those provisions of that particular agreement consistently, guaranteed in the context of that case was referring to the guarantee in terms of the overall term of the annuity and not in terms of the relative monthly amount that was going to be paid. Here, we don't have a release that's so specifically tied to the mere payment and purchase of an annuity, though. The release is connected to something like in consideration thereof, and everything in the contract could be read to mean that what is being guaranteed by the government is that these payments of this annuity are actually going to happen.
Your Honor, there's no language in the agreement, and there was language in Massey, and there's language in the other cases that indicate there was a type of guarantee or responsibility primarily on the government to make the cases. And I would like to just first mention in Massey, since that was brought up, I think it's important to note it wasn't just there's not just guarantee language. In Massey included language providing that the annuity will result in distributions on behalf of the United States and that the distribution shall be paid. That's important language, and in Shaw, the court relied on that language and said that the periodic payments as being made on behalf of the United States suggested an ongoing obligation of the government.
Right. In the Massey opinion itself, our holding did not rely on that phrase, on behalf of the United States. Is that right? It simply quoted the snippets of will result in distributions and shall be paid. And then concluded those two snippets are unambiguous and the payments are mandatory and the government must be responsible for their payment. No one else is a party to the agreement.
Your Honor, we believe that as an initial matter, that language is in the contract in Massey, and it was before, and it was in the mentioned by the court, and the fact that it didn't specifically focus on that doesn't mean that language is not significant. And in Shaw, the court interpreted that language as the basis for the decision in Massey. So there were the courts were coming down different ways on these contracts, and I believe in the last few years the court has issued a few opinions that have tried to clarify where to draw the line, and it seems to have drawn the line in Shaw. It drew a fairly bright line.
The Nutt opinion does a characterization of the Massey opinion too, right?
Excuse me?
The Nutt opinion also performs a characterization of the Massey opinion.
It does.
I believe it focuses on the fact that the Massey opinion says are guaranteed, and that is that was a key reason for why the court in Massey concluded that in that contract, the government was on the hook because the Nutt agreement did not have the "are guaranteed" language.
Well, going back to that language, it's all monthly payments are guaranteed for 30 years or the life of Jennifer, whichever is longer, is consistent with only one meaning. It's not ambiguous. It means you get the benefit of the doubt if the person who's entitled to the annuity payments were not to live for 30 years, the estate would continue to collect for the remainder. However, if the person lived for 80 years, the 30 years is not a limit, and the person would collect for another 50 years. And that's clearly what that means, and I believe that's how Shaw explained it as well. So this guarantee language is used for that sole purpose. And
what do you think Nutt meant then when it referenced the "are guaranteed" language in the Massey contract?
One moment, Your Honor. I'm trying to remember exactly what Nutt said about that. What my notes here say that the court rejected the idea that there was a guarantee by the government, and the court noted that the United States is not mentioned in the paragraph specifying the future payments by the annuity. I guess that was probably looking at its own provision there. I don't recall what they said about Massey in that case. I apologize.
Let me draw your attention back to the second page of the release of the agreement.
Yes.
And the paragraph that actually states the release language that starts with "in consideration hereof." When I read that "in consideration hereof," then I ask, well, in consideration of what? What does hereof mean? And if I accept your argument, then what that means is in consideration of a timetable. That's it. Nothing else.
That's what it means. What it, the hereof means in our view. And then
really?
And again, we're
so
looking.
So you settled this case, and you're trying to convince us that the land close agreed to a promise of a timetable, a calendar, and nothing else, and they relieved the government of all liability.
No, what Ms. Landclose agreed to is what's in the first paragraph of the settlement or in paragraph one.
Well, it says hereof. I mean, I think I take that to mean the entire agreement for us to look at it. And when I do that, I see the promise of the purchase annuity. I see a guarantee of money. There's money amounts there. And then there's a schedule. And it seems to me that the Landclose in for the promise, or rather for the consideration that's paid hereof, that includes all three of those elements. How can they just include one? The calendar.
Your Honor, includes, there are other provisions. There are, for example, the payment to the attorney. But what it does is it releases the government once the government, in our view, makes the lump sum payment of $200,000 and then purchases an annuity that obligates the annuity company to make the payments listed in the schedule right there.
No, it doesn't. Does not say that it obligates the annuity company. This does not release the annuity company. It releases the government.
That's what I'm. Yes, I agree.
And when we ask, in consideration of what? Then I look at the entire agreement, and I see a calendar, I see amounts, and a timetable. It cannot be that the Landclose agreed to release the federal government just for a timetable. Just dates and no money.
Well, the government purchased an annuity that paid Ms. Landclose for over 25 years, the full amount, and that's what in our view, that's what the release was for.
It didn't pay her for the full amount for the 30 years that it was supposed to. That's
because
what the license requires.
But the government, the question isn't only the release, the question is where in this agreement is the government obligated in the event that it purchases an annuity?
Maybe we can find the answer to your question when we look at the language that says all monthly payments above are guaranteed. Well, who's making that guarantee? There's only two parties here, the Landclose and the federal government. So who's making that guarantee of those payments?
Yes, and we would go back to Shaw again, which explained, and other cases that have similar language, but Shaw expressly said that's a term of art. And the term of art in this case is
If we determine that it's not a term of art in this case for various reasons, then would you say that you would lose?
Your Honor, I would not see that because it's clear on its face that what it is saying is that you have a guarantee of payment for life or for 30 years, whichever is longer. That's what it means.
No,
it doesn't mean.
But it doesn't say that. It says all monthly payments above are guaranteed.
But it doesn't. But it's the idea there was that the annuity would provide those payments, would be purchased in an amount sufficient because government has to pay for the annuity. So whatever it costs to pay Ms. Landclose for 30 years or life, whichever is longer, if it was just 30 years, presumably the premium would have been lower. But there was a guaranteed life payment. And there was also a guarantee that if Ms. Landclose didn't survive for 30 years.
Can you say there's a guaranteed life payment or these amounts are guaranteed?
That the...
What is it that's guaranteed? You're talking about the money. You can't. It can't be it's not possible or feasible for you to say that the promise that's being made is an empty promise, just dates.
That was the same exact type of promise in Shaw. And Shaw held that, and that's a decision of this court that looked at the other decisions, that the agreement did not make the government a guarantor of annuity payments, and it was very similar language.
It wasn't similar. In the case that you're talking about where they weren't the guarantor, you're talking only about Shaw because Nutt did that, but it didn't have the guarantee language. And it actually distinguished itself from Massey entirely on the guarantee language. But you're only talking about Shaw. And yes, Shaw had the guarantee language, but Shaw also had a release that it tied specifically to the paragraph on the purchase of the annuity, but not to the paragraph on the annuity payments and going forward for life. So they released the government once the government purchased the annuity. That's what their settlement says. This doesn't say that.
Well, but the other thing about a release is that there still has to be an obligation first of the government to actually make the to guarantee the annuity payment. So when it's a guarantee, it's usually...
And Massey said in identical language, this, our Nutt decision says when Massey had this guaranteed language, that's the critical difference that put the government on the hook. Shaw came along and said, no, it's not in our case because we have this release.
Yes, Massey also, though, again, to come back, says that the annuity will result in distributions on behalf of the United States. So in that case, the annuity, the United States is the obligor, and that language, or that type of language, is absent here because the only promise here in the Lankfos case is to purchase an annuity and to make lump sum payments. In cases where those are the only promises, the court has held the government not to be liable. And even in
who drafted the release in this case?
We don't know, Your Honor. The release was drafted, the agreement is 1986, and that's never been determined at this point.
Well, what about the fact that it has the docketing number for the United States on the front? Isn't that sufficient evidence? You're not disputing that you drafted. They allege you drafted the release. They point to the docket number, and you don't dispute that you drafted the release.
We don't know. Their brief didn't explain why this number on there, that OJC number on there, means the government drafted the release. There's just no way of knowing from the record before the court, and plaintiff speculated that the government drafted the release, but if you look at plaintiff's brief, it doesn't actually...
I don't think they speculate. I think they allege it, right? They allege the government drafted the release.
Well, alleging, this is summary judgment motion, alleging the government drafted the release isn't proof that the government drafted the release. There's no indication who drafted the
language. So if there is potential ambiguity and they're alleging you drafted the release and you put no evidence on to the contrary and they point to this docket number on the first page that they claim, do you dispute that docketing number is the United States?
Your Honor, I don't know what that docketing number is, but even if it is the United States' docketing number, that doesn't mean that the government drafted this entire agreement. We don't know if I don't believe they have the same counsel. However, the counsel here may have drafted the agreement or pieces of this agreement or suggested this term or presented the payment schedule for the annuity. There's no evidence one way or another, who drafted which terms in this case.
A quick question.
Yes.
This is now the fourth case that's come before us dealing with these settlement agreements where the government agreed to pay for an annuity, and then the annuity company goes into financial distress, and then there's a shortfall on the annuity payments. Do you know how many other cases are like this that are out there? I mean, this all happened, you know, in the 80s, and then this particular insurance company had problems. I mean, are there many other of these kinds of cases?
Your Honor, I don't know the answers, but I know that there's at least one more that's out there that hasn't been adjudicated yet. I don't think there are a whole lot. I can't really answer that.
Okay.
And I don't know what might be pending in other places.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We are way beyond our time on this case.
Thank you.
Mr. Dahl has a few minutes of rebuttal time. Mr. Dahl, we can't hear you. You must have your microphone muted.
My apologies. I don't have much in rebuttal other than I would urge this court again to apply standard rules of contract, that the plain and ordinary terms within this settlement agreement mean that the government guaranteed these payments in the event of default. And we think that's, in this particular case, is clear in reading the document as a whole. It's very much unlike the Shaw agreement, much closer to the Massey agreement, and also just the agreement itself. And the change of the tenses to are guaranteed, we think that shows as a matter of law that the government guaranteed these monthly payments. So we would ask for relief that the judgment of the Federal Court of Federal Claims be reversed and vacated, and that this court find liability on the part of the government for the shortfall.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both counsel. The case is taken under submission.